Hey, everybody, it's Robert Weissman. Thank you for being on the line with us. Thank you for joining this Public Citizen Town Hall to take stock of what happened with the election on Tuesday and how we are going to respond as Public Citizen together. We're going to get going in just a moment. We're making calls still to many more supporters, but lots of you are on the line now. We're around 5,000 attendees for this conversation. We're eager to get going. Lisa Gilbert, my co-president, will begin the conversation by reflecting on what happened and how we're reacting to it, and also reminding us of what we did during the first term of Donald Trump and how Public Citizen was able to make a difference in that moment. I'm going to follow up looking forward with some thoughts on what we see as our response in now this second Donald Trump presidency. We've got great challenges ahead, but we're an amazing organization. We've done remarkable things together in the past under duress, and we're going to do that again going forward. So we so much appreciate everything you do with and for us. We're excited to have this conversation. We're going to get it going in just a moment. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in the queue to ask a question, hit star three to get in the queue to ask a question or make a comment. We'll be getting going in just one more moment now. We've dialed through to tens of thousands of supporters. Just a few more to go, and we'll get this thing going. Thank you so much. Stay with us. We'll be starting just in a moment.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lisa Gilbert, co-president of Public Citizen. You were just hearing from Robert Weissman, the other co-president. We're here together today to speak with our incredible supporters. We're trying to make meaning of what happened this week. We'll be offering reflections and also connecting with all of you on your questions and thoughts and feelings in this challenging time. If you have questions, if you have those thoughts, please jump in the queue to raise them by hitting *3. You can do that now or at any point during the conversation. And with that, we've reached out to thousands of you, and I've got a great group on the line, so I think we're going to get started. Let me say again, for anybody who joined just a second ago, I'm Lisa Gilbert, co-president of Public Citizen. Robert Weissman and I are here together today to speak with all of you, our incredible supporters around the country, to try to reflect on what happened, and then open it up to conversation with all of you. Again, hit *3. To do that, to raise a question or have a comment. So starting with how I'm feeling, I'll just say that I am reeling from last night, that Donald Trump is now our 47th president is really hard to get your arms around. It's just shocking. It's an astounding feat, really, given his criminal convictions, indictments, and blatant authoritarianism comments. You know, MAGA Republicans made it clear during the race that they were determined to seize power by any means, at any cost, so they can rule for billionaires and greedy corporations. Voices were silenced, threats were unleashed, lies were spread, and really, you know, everything that could be done to shield Trump from consequences for attempting to overthrow our last election happened. And it is just horrifying to me that the majority of our country made this choice, voting for a felon rather than a supremely qualified woman. So I know we're all feeling a lot of those same feelings, and as much as it feels just completely incomprehensible that people would choose this man, I think a key thing for us to understand is that although the American electorate is alienated, frustrated, they're not actually pro-fascist. We lost the presidency, but we have not lost the fight against fascism, and there is still a huge fight to be had. Donald Trump is going to come into office and move from being a change candidate to his supporters to being someone who's going to enact a lot of really awful and unpopular stuff, stuff that most people will not like. People voted for Trump, but they are not signed off on everything that he says he will do. And in wild contrast to that, as you all know, as our supporters, our agenda, the Public Citizen agenda, is the people's. It's democracy. It's fixing our climate. It's healthcare that functions and covers people's needs, and it is deeply popular. So this is not the moment that we throw up our hands in despair that the most incompetent and corrupt president in American history is returning, but instead, I think it's the moment where we decide to fight and that we should have the supreme confidence in the righteousness of our cause. And I know, I'm proud to say that at Public Citizen, I think we have the right team for that job. You know, I don't think we need to sugarcoat it. You know, Trump is a deeply damaging president, and he returns to the White House, you know, full of vengeance and not constrained by that many guardrails. And of course, as you all know, the Supreme Court's decision this year, effectively giving him complete immunity for any official act, makes him even more dangerous. But we have been here before, which, while terrifying in some ways, is also kind of comforting to me, because we know that we can take him on because we have done it before. We have a long list of victories over Donald Trump. In his first term, we did a lot to take him on and to win tangible successes. Just a couple examples, you know, we shed light on the unethical profiteering that was happening at Trump businesses throughout his time in office. We found more than 370 political candidates, foreign governments, businesses, corporate groups, religious groups, and other entities that held events at his properties, shone a light on this, and led to some change. You know, we exposed the grifters who used their connections to Donald Trump to make money lobbying on the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, finding lobbyists were connected to him through his campaign, the inaugural committee, or other parts of the administration, and making it a lot harder for them to engage. We did hugely impressive court work using creative litigation to win victories. We sued Trump's HHS for unlawfully terminating 5-year grants awarded under the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Program. They were trying to stop a successful program that reduces teen pregnancy based on an ideological-driven crusade. It really demonstrates their perspective on health, but it also shows that we can win. We also sued and forced disclosure of the White House visitors' log. You know, without that information, we would not have had the clear picture we did about the massive amount of influence peddling happening in the administration and been able to do additional work to try to halt them. And we forced, through litigation, the United States Postal Service to deliver absentee ballots in a timely way, which helped preserve the outcome of the 2020 election, and so much more. I think the key takeaway of this is that we didn't knuckle under to Trump then, and we are not about to now. And, you know, we have to pivot, we have to recalibrate, but I know that we can do that. So Rob will talk more about the next steps in our plan, how we're thinking about updating and adapting and changing what we've done to innovate to meet the moment. But before I hand it to him, I just want to say Public Citizen is in this fight, and we are staying in it. And we will never stop fighting for freedom, for workers' rights, for our health care, for making sure that all of our votes count, for reigning in corporate power, for clean air, clean water, a healthy climate, for the rule of law, and overall for love and understanding, not hate and division. I know this is a hard and disillusioning moment. We all know how dangerous Trump will be in his second term, and we're appropriately alarmed for our nation and the world. But I think, at least for me, you know, this just makes me even more determined to mitigate the damage and confront and defeat his authoritarianism head on. And I couldn't be happier than to be doing that with our amazing team at Public Citizen and hand in hand with all of you, our truly incredible supporters. So Rob, I want to hand it over to you for your reflections and thoughts on forward-looking work.
Thanks so much, Lisa. And let me pick up exactly where you stopped and talk just for a moment about the moment and how it feels for me and what we're all going through and how we can move forward just as human beings and emotionally. And then I want to talk about the work program that we see for Public Citizen. You know, all of us who work at Public Citizen, and I know all of you who support us, we do this work because we take it seriously. So I think we understand very profoundly the multidimensional threat that Donald Trump poses to how our democracy is supposed to work, to the well-being of the planet and even the future of civilization, no exaggeration, to basic norms of decency, to justice and health, consumer protection, things that he has said and promises to do, targeting immigrants, people of color. Quite hard to wrap your head around. It's hard to understand how the country could have elected this person again. It is a difficult, difficult time. And it's an emotional time for those of you us who take it seriously. There's no way not to feel bad. There's no reason not to feel bad. But I think what is really important for all of us to do, and this is something we should not do individually, it's something we should do together, that we can feel distressed. We should feel distressed, but we can't let ourselves feel despair. We've been saying determination, not despair. If we despair, if we think it's hopeless, then we drop out and we make it hopeless. The thing that directs the country where it should go, that mitigates the damage that this man and his acolytes intend to inflict, is us together engaging, resisting, protesting, and insisting on common decency and humanity. For me, make it an I statement, but I think it's true really for most people. Working, engaging, even on really hard things, is the best way to deal with a sense of grief that we've got about this and the horror that we feel in the pits in our stomach. The best way to feel better is to do something, to make it better, to take action. And, you know, sometimes that's something you just do on your own alone at home, but it's not by yourself. It's together and it's in community. And so what we hope that this town hall is one small piece of is an ongoing effort to, again, try to deepen the public citizen sense of community and family, that you feel part of what we all together are doing. We certainly feel that about all of you. And that you feel some comfort, some safety, some reinforcement, and some power and hope in what we're all doing together. Okay, what are we going to do? So, of course, we don't know everything. We know that Donald Trump is going to introduce chaos and corruption and cruelty. There is a plan. Project 2025 is a plan. And they'll use some of that, and they'll make up some other stuff, and we're going to have to see how things unfold. But even against that uncertainty, we have a pretty good sense of the kinds of things we're going to do. So we have an extraordinary research team of Public Citizen, and we're going to put that team to work examining and disclosing and uncovering the vast money flows and corruption and conflicts of interest that already pervade the campaign, already pervade the sort of transition arrangement that Trump has in process, and will absolutely be pervasive during his presidency. With that, we will, as Lisa described in the first round, be able to hone in on individuals who are heavily conflicted and knock them out of office, reduce their power. We did that successfully in the first term. It's not a matter of just sort of sounding the alarm and showing their hypocrisy or their conflicts. It's making a difference to making their tenure in office unsustainable and to weaken their ability to deliver for the industries or the special interests that they came from. So we did that the first time with a lot of success. We're certain that we're going to be able to do that again. As Lisa said, we also led more mobilizations and protests than I can count, including around both impeachments. In 2016, we've got plans underway with allies with an infrastructure already in place to start doing that again with the Trump 2 administration. Those protests, I think, made an enormous difference in the way the Trump administration proceeded in the first round and the way the opposition did. And I think the Women's March, which was not something we helped lead, the Women's March changed the orientation of Democrats to being an opposition party the first to go around. But along the way, the protests and the street actions and the mobilization and the public agitation protected the investigations of Trump, restrained abuses that the administration otherwise would have committed, and paved the way to changing an overall national narrative about who he was, and made a really fundamental difference. I think everything else we do is strengthened by protests. And that includes our work in the courts, which is the last thing I want to mention before we open up for conversation. We will, as Lisa, we did in the last round, as Lisa said, litigate heavily against Trump, and we're gearing up to do that at scale again. Some of the things we did the first time we'll do again. Some more theories, some more issues, but there are going to be new things. Here's examples of what we think we're going to be looking at. In the first presidency, Trump invoked emergency powers in a limited range of areas to do things that otherwise would have been illegal or unconstitutional. And we litigated over those things. We expect him to seek broad application of emergency powers in the second term. Those things are, the invocation of emergency powers is restrained by law, and we imagine suing him repeatedly to stop the abuse of emergency powers and derail really hideous actions he might try to take using emergency powers. There's something called the Impoundment Act, which we're expert in and plan to litigate around. That deals with whether a president can refuse to spend money that's been appropriated by Congress. The answer is the president cannot. Nor can the president take money that's been appropriated for Congress and use it for some purpose that it wasn't appropriated for. So that'll be another kind of area that we'll be doing lots of litigation on. These are things that in the abstract sound important, but maybe not central to people's everyday lives. But when you connect it to, say, an effort to round up immigrants, to arrest your enemies, to stop funding climate change proposals, and more, you can see that it translates into very real things on the ground, and we plan to be leading the way in blocking Trump and the courts. I'm sure we'll have a conversation about whether the courts are an actual avenue open to blocking Trump. The short answer is they're not perfect, but they still are. I think at the end of the day, all these things, there's going to be much more as we adapt to their specific plans on healthcare or on public campaign finance or what they're trying to do around financial regulation and on and on. But you get some sense of what we're looking at. This is an organization, as Lisa said, with enormous capacity, with a history of taking on autocrats as presidents, with a history also of making a really fundamental difference. And we do that not just by having an exceptional staff, which we do, but by the collective effort of 500,000 members and supporters, which is you. So we're really honored to be working in tandem with you. We've got some really big challenges ahead. And we're eager to collaborate in the effort to do the work that we have to do and that we will do and that we will succeed at. So with that, we're going to just appreciate you all once again, and let's start with some questions. We've got a big queue. We're going to do our best to try to get through them. Stephanie from New Jersey, my friend, we're going to begin with you. I'm going to click you on and let us know what you want to talk about.
Great. I so appreciate having this town hall, Rob. Thanks so much. I would like to discuss the Supreme Court. Is there any way to save the Supreme Court? I understand that Sonia Sotomayor is not well, and if she were to retire now and Biden were to select a successor, would there be time with this Congress to approve it using the Amy Coney Barrett as a precedent? Did you get my question?
I'm sorry. Yes, I did, and I muted myself, so you couldn't hear my answer. Thank you, Stephanie. Thanks, everybody. Here I'm back. We were just talking about this earlier today. We don't have any windows into Sotomayor's health. There's rumors around it. Obviously, she knows, and she knows the risks if she is facing health consequence. I don't think it's obvious that even if she were to drop out, that it'd be possible to ram through another justice. It would require agreement from Senators Manchin and Sinema, which is possible, but certainly not guaranteed. So we don't have any real window on that. We're hoping that, you know, we think very highly of Justice Sotomayor, that she's thinking not just about the cases in front of her, but her role in the court, and could only hope that she's making smart decisions for the long term. But I'm not, no special insight for me, no breaking news on this call about her health. But we're certainly monitoring it, and we're certainly going to be very engaged at the Supreme Court no matter what. Okay, thank you, Stephanie. We're going to go next to Mary from Pennsylvania. Mary, you're on. Mary, if you're there,
Hello?
You're live. Hey, go ahead, Mary.
Okay. Thank you. My question has to do with Project 2025. Many of us are concerned about the implementation of some of those disastrous recommendations in that document. And although Trump denies it, many of us believe that that's going to be a kind of a pathway for them. Do you have any plans to monitor that?
Yes, we do.
Thanks
Lisa,
for that.
Let me ask you to say more.
Yeah, thanks for that. We are deeply concerned about Project 2025, but also in some ways grateful for it because it's given us a very clear blueprint. Notwithstanding Trump's disavowal of it, the people who wrote it are very likely to be part of his administration, and they've told us what they're planning to do. You know, not all of it is possible. Some of it is just extreme, beyond even the scope and capacity of an administration, but there's a lot of it that is a playbook that we should be monitoring closely. And so that is our plan. You know, they have things in there about what they expect their FDA to look like, what they think should happen to the Department of Education, which is doing away with it, you know, how they think the CFPB should rein in what they've been doing to take on, you know, corporations who are ripping people off. All of that, we'll be watching closely to see where we can, you know, jump in, take action using our grassroots, working with all of you, where we can sue because they're overstepping what's actually possible, using the administrative state, which we expect them to make mistakes like that. And also when we need to mobilize a broader movement, you know, depending on the level of outrage and how much is going on any given day with the Trump administration, which could be a lot. We intend to work closely with other organizations to mobilize in bigger and bolder ways. But it's both, again, a blessing and a curse to know, you know, where they're planning to go and to be able to prepare is fantastic. But obviously what's in there is truly terrifying.
Correct.
Yeah, I would just quickly
very
add
terrifying.
The Project 2025 has an obsession with abortion rights and issues around trans kids. So that's a big central theme. But beyond that, it really is looking at the workings of government and the regulatory structure of government, and that's right. Public citizen's bread and butter stuff. So that the Project 2025 agenda is kind of the anti-public citizen agenda. So you can be absolutely certain that we're going to not be both monitoring what they're doing and fighting the implementation of those plans. Thank you so much, Mary. Tim, we're going to go over – Tim from New Jersey, we're going to go over to you now.
Thanks. She was just mentioning about coalition building, and that's the main reason I'm calling, is that we're not going to have much impact at all, even with groups as large as this, if we try to go it alone. And it's going to be so important to get together with other organizations at all levels to communicate, to coordinate, and to fight, you know, this monster that's been built out there with the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society, because they've got deep pockets, and we're going to need a lot of work to be able to stand up to them so that other people can support, for instance, the efforts that Public Citizen is taking forward in courts and things like that. So that's my main point, is the importance of that and really starting to build those coalitions, because it hasn't always been as good as I think we could do in the past, and it's going to be important.
Thanks, Tim. Just really want to appreciate your comment. You are singing my song, if you will. I firmly believe in coalition building and working with other organizations and making sure we double and then redouble our impact by doing that. And I think you're right. You know, this is an extreme moment, and it's going to require more infrastructure, more planning, more working together, more thinking about strategy across our movement to win. You know, Public Citizen runs a significant number of coalitions ourselves. We run, you know, big ones in the health space, the environmental space, the democracy space. But we need a coalition of coalitions. We need everyone working together and thinking as big as we can. You know, one I do want to frame up, which I think is going to become even more important, is our Not Above the Law coalition. So this is a grouping of over 150 grassroots, constitutional groups, the government groups, accountability groups, who actually came together early in the first Trump administration to try to push back on rule of law violations, all the places where you know, we weren't prepared at that juncture to see Trump break norms and do things that had never been done before in the office of the president. That coalition has stayed around working primarily on accountability, you know, the things that he did wrong, like reject the peaceful transfer of power. And so we are in place and ready to switch and pivot to the moment we're in now. So that coalition, I think, is going to become just an essential clearinghouse for fighting back on some of the fronts we expect to see, particularly on democracy issues. But really, thank you for those comments. Totally agree.
One of our mentors in the public interest movement and from another organization who's still highly engaged has labeled Lisa, I'm not sure if directly to her, but to others, including me, labeled Lisa as the queen of coalitions. Lisa is an extraordinary coalition builder, but it's really a central skill set of Public Citizen, and it's central because it's our theory of exactly as you said, Tim, like we do amazing work at Public Citizen, but we need lots of people in the fight collectively together pushing the same way to make big change happen. Melissa, let me kick it over to you. I think you've got a question about money and politics.
Yes, thank you very much for giving us a chance to give our views. My question is, how can we prioritize or somehow bring federal legislation of some sort to put limits on the dollar amount of donations to candidates? I ask this because I just read an article yesterday that approximately $2 billion came in from basically 10 mega donors, and 70% of that went to Trump.
Such an important point, Melissa, and you know, something that we obsess about at Public Citizen. We care so much about the proliferation of big money in politics, and as you say, it, you know, it comes from a handful of, you know, the richest among us, from billionaires or major corporations who, you know, are able to direct their funds to, you know, single causes, single candidates, and in so doing, change our policy outcomes, change what we're able to accomplish. So just a big, longstanding crusade on our part. You know, have to be realistic about the chances for federal legislation in the arena we are now entering. Yep. You know, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to pass sweeping reform right now at the federal level. However, we do have a theory for moving things at the state level to help us win at the federal level at our next opportunity moment. So a part of our strategy here when we think about money and politics in particular is moving reforms in blue states where we can. We think, as is kind of a cliched expression, but it's true, the states are the laboratories of democracy. Our ability to pass things there not only makes the case because you know, things change in the state where you're able to achieve such reforms, but also shows the demand, which in turn helps us win things at the federal level. So that's a piece of what we're going to do. We're also going to just use the conflicts of interest, the money in politics, and the policy outcomes that happen over the next little bit to make our case to the public, you know, in the media, and continue to beat the drum. I think, you know, a large part of what we do over the next little bit is going to be that, just, you know, thinking of our campaigns as longer term than we would like, but fighting as hard as we can for when that opportunity moment emerges.
Okay, well, that sounds great, because I just think that, you know, we're getting to the point now where people are buying an election, and it's a
yep.
corporation, like you say, or these, you know, 10 individuals that have so much money that it really almost negates our vote.
I couldn't agree more. And thank you for raising it.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Melissa. We're with you. Don't worry. we're going to be, as Lisa said, we're going to be working on it as best we can in this circumstance, including, I think, honing in a really big way on the role of Elon Musk, who probably was the biggest donor and has all kinds of conflicts. And just to have the richest person in the world exerting the kind of chaotic political influence that he has, it's not something that democracy can tolerate. And, you know, we know we need structural solutions to this with legislation and a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. We've been working on that since the day Citizens United was passed, and we continue to gain momentum, and we intend to succeed in winning that constitutional amendment. Susan from Pennsylvania, let me push it over to you.
Thank you. First of all, thanks for all you do. I'm feeling terrible, devastated. I'm 79, and I live off of Social Security. If I were to lose it, it would be... I would not have an income. Do you think he will leave it alone?
I would say the short answer is yes. I think there's a more complicated answer, but I think you should feel like you're going to be okay. If there are any threats, I guarantee you we'll do everything possible to lay on the tracks to stop that. Trump has actually had some political sense about this, different from others in his party, and he doesn't want to take on Social Security directly. I do not believe there will be a threat to existing recipients or to people who are older than, say, 67. I think there are a lot of Republicans in Congress who are in the rush to say they want to cut government spending, even if they want to cut taxes and increase defense spending, are going to consider options to maybe raise the eligibility age for Social Security. If that happens, and it hasn't been floated yet, but it's reasonably likely, we will absolutely be leading the charge against it. But, you know, the 79-year-old already on an independent, no guarantees in this world, but I don't think you need to worry about that. We got a lot of things to worry about with Donald Trump. I don't think you have to add that one to your list. And I just want to validate, you know, it's hard to wrap your head around this moment. It's really hard. It's really upsetting. It's right to be really confused about how this could come to pass and to be really upset. But I think, again, not to give into despair, not to lose sight of how we can do things together, because we absolutely think that we can, and that's exactly what we're planning to do. Kiki from Alabama, let me put you online and hear your question.
Thank you. Thank you for giving us a chance to, maybe air our grievances a little bit and feel that we're connected a little. My concern is public citizen, because Trump has spoken about the enemy within the word doesn't come to me. With the DOJ, you know, basically controlling the DOJ, and I'm concerned that he will close you down. Or do you have a plan for this? How are you going to protect public citizen as an entity here?
Well, first, Kiki, thank you for your concern, and we really appreciate it. What you're raising is something that we're taking really seriously. And I should also say organizations across the ecosystem are taking seriously. We've had lots of conversations with other groups to talk about best practices for protecting ourselves. You know, first and foremost, we're making sure that we are in compliance with all rules, that we are, not in any way vulnerable to attacks that a DOJ or an IRS that are controlled by Trump, might make. We are, making sure that we are as careful as we can possibly be. Beyond that, we are thinking about security. Very important to make sure that, we are all safe, that we're careful with information we share, that we do everything we can to protect our staff and our supporters, as we do this incredibly important work. I think the bottom line of your question is, will progressive groups be attacked? Will the infrastructure we're all trying to build, as we think about resistance, be attacked? I think we should assume that they will try. And so what we have to do is be ready. And that is something you can rest assured we are. We are thinking about it. We're preparing. And we want to make sure that we can resist whatever we need to. So just thank you again for raising it.
Yeah, let me just echo that. So we are prepping, just to be more specific. You know, we look heavily at our IT systems and any vulnerability. We feel like we spend a lot of energy making sure that our cybersecurity is strong. We're examining the physical safety of our buildings, which we feel good about. I think the biggest area of vulnerability for groups will be compliance with the law, especially like in financial areas, and making sure you're reporting, lobbying correctly, and things like that. And while we're checking over those things again, you'll be happy to know what you expect. We are really scrupulous about those things all the time. Not because we think that we were imagining a scenario where we had to be able to protect ourselves, but because we take the rules really seriously. And we want to make sure that we follow them. So we are not not being cavalier about this in any way, but we think we're doing the things that we need to do to protect ourselves. And, of course, no way to know how things are going to unfold, but we are being careful, and we really appreciate the question. Jay from California, let me send it over to you.
Hey, hello. I'm happy to be able to ask you this question. I feel like we must have failed, all of us. I feel like everybody on this call shares fundamental beliefs and things like that, but we somehow haven't gotten our message through to a large swath of the public. And although buying elections is part of the problem, I think we also have to talk about our narrative. So I just wonder, are you guys thinking about the narrative and how to speak to the broader audience going forward?
Yeah, it's a great question. We could spend a couple of days talking about this, so I can't give you a full answer. But to the specific question, yeah, we spent a ton of time thinking about it. We think about it inside Public Citizen, to the point about coalitions. We're spending a lot of time having those conversations as well. Here are a few reflections, and Lisa may want to jump in after I go. I think one thing that makes the narrative conversation really difficult is the kind of information ecosystem we're in now, where a lot of people rely on Fox News, and then now Twitter has really been taken over as a self-contained right-wing conspiracist social media space. It's more complicated because, like, we're active on Twitter, but at the end of the day, it's now really dominated by Elon Musk and people he approves of. Those things really reinforce a lot of bad narratives, and it's hard to break through with people who are not listening, who you can't talk to, because they're not, because we're not able to have conversations with people, but because their information systems are closed off from us. That's one big problem. I think there's at the end of the day, underlying the narrative issue is people, and to a very considerable extent, is people's economic circumstance. And that's a policy issue first and foremost. And lots of people feel like they've been left out. Lots of people feel like the system is rigged against them. And by and large, they're right. And I think they feel frustrated that not having heard answers from more conventional politicians or just from Democrats, they find answers, as weird as they might seem to us, but they speak to at least the emotion from Donald Trump. So those are really big challenges for us, but I think that analysis begins to suggest the solution, which is, we have to defend basic norms of civility and key concepts like the rule of law, but we don't have to defend the system that's rigged. We should be explaining how it's rigged and for whom it's rigged, and offering real solutions. So narrative-wise, I think that's where we are trying to go with things. I mean, if you're worried that you can't afford your medicines, Like, Donald Trump isn't the answer. The problem is Big Pharma, and the answer is dealing with Big Pharma's monopoly power. You know, if you're worried about costs feeling out of control, problem is, aside from some temporary supply side shocks, it's been corporate price gouging. The answer isn't Donald Trump. It's taking on those corporations and cracking down on their abusive practices. If you feel like the jobs that your family once had aren't available anymore, the problem is corporate rigged trade deals. The answer isn't Donald Trump. It's fixing those trade rules so they work for everyday people and not for large corporations. So that's our narrative. I don't know that's perfect, but that's our theory of it, is how we're trying to direct it. But even if we're getting it exactly right, which I'm not claiming, but even if we are, it is extra challenging because of these complicated information ecosystems. It's going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take a lot of work over a long period of time. Lisa, do you want to throw anything more, or should we go to the next question?
Well, let me just throw in one thing in addition to co-signing everything you just said. It's a little bit to what I said at the top. You know, people voted for Trump, but they're not signing on for everything he says he will do. I mean, you could just have to look at the ballot initiatives that passed around the country to understand that. I mean, people, you know, voted on issues like defeating private school vouchers or eliminating the capital gains tax or actually limiting super PAC money in politics in Maine. You know, there were populist issues around the country where we won. And I think, you know, right now we just have to remember that we can use that to our advantage and we can message to people on that. Once Trump comes into power and starts doing things that are unpopular, unpopulist, that people really don't like, there's an opportunity there to talk about that and a narrative wedge that we can use. So agree with our frame and our discussion of corporate power and what Rob was saying on that front, but I actually do think we're going to have an opportunity moment when he comes in.
Great. Well, let me just thank you all for staying on. We're going to keep plowing through some questions here. Lori from New Mexico, let me send it over to you.
Hi, thank you. I'm really concerned about the possibility of Joe Biden being able to do some executive orders while he has immunity, and wonder specifically about, could he like make citizens of our asylum seekers who are just, the courts are so backed up they can't even get their asylum hearings, or could he relieve medical debt as a executive order?
So I love this question, Lori. I've actually been thinking about it quite a lot with friends across our org and a couple other ones. We've been calling our fight to figure out what Joe Biden can do in these 3 months, YOLO Joe, or you only live once, Joe. We want him to do everything he possibly can in this time period. And there is a lot. You actually just named two important ones. We've been thinking about things like granting clemency to key groups, certifying the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, thinking of ways that we might be able to mitigate the Schedule F threat, which, if folks don't know, that's this horrific thing in Project 2025, which says that they will turn career civil servants into political government workers so that they can be fired. There might be ways that we can facilitate collective bargaining agreements to mitigate that, sort of locking in grandfathered job protections. So things like that, exactly like what you said, the things I mentioned, and much more. We really want him to fulfill the promise of this time period because, you know, if we do it right, it's a little bit of a kind of lock the doors, create speed bumps moment where, you know, we can set up some hurdles to the incoming administration and protect some people as we do so. So just really appreciate this question. And yes, we are thinking about this a lot.
All right. Just want to appreciate you all. Thank you again. We're going to try to get through a couple more before we run out of time here. I've got a couple Beverlys in the queue. Let me go first to Beverly from New York.
Beverly Alves, and I'm an advocate for health care for everyone and the medical specialty of palliative care. I spoke at the National Academy of Medicine, and I wrote the resolution to the American Federation of Teachers. When our Constitution was written, there was no health care. George Washington was bled to death for a sore throat. So now that there's a tremendous difference between those who are able to get health care and those who can't, we need to work on getting health care either into our Constitution or into law as a human right.
Well, Beverly, thank you. And I hope you know we're 100% with you. We spent a lot of effort trying to ensure that everyone has the right to health care. We think there's one real way to do that, which is to have a Medicare-like system for everybody, Medicare for all. I mean, we've been campaigning to both win Medicare for all, but also along the way to expand Medicare to cover more services and to be available to more people. If we'd had a Harris administration, I think we were poised to make real progress in expanding the services that Medicare covers for existing beneficiaries, including home health care, cousin to the palliative care issue you're talking about, and also possibly to lower the eligibility age so we'd start to bring more people into a system that provides care as a matter of right and doesn't discriminate based on ability to pay and is vastly, vastly, vastly more efficient and effective than the for-profit system. I can't honestly say I think that's going to happen under the Trump administration. I think to the contrary, the big fight is going to be to hold on to what we have. And we're ramping up our campaigns to do that. I think there'll be a couple ways that the administration is likely to chop at the access to health care in this country. I don't think they're going to go back to trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but I do think that they're going to first try to expand privatized Medicare and make that easier so people are getting inferior coverage, but also starting to bleed the Medicare budget, because privatized Medicare, sometimes called Medicare Advantage, is vastly more expensive than traditional Medicare is, even while providing fewer services. I think we're going to be looking at efforts to undermine the effectiveness of the Affordable Care Act. People want to go back to Project 2025, that and other comparable agenda for the Trump administration, call on really undermining the consumer protections in that law so that making it possible for people to just obtain junk plans, like super high deductible plans that are very expensive, as an alternative to legitimate health care coverage. That's something I'm very sure we're going to see them push on. And then in the area of Medicaid, they're talking about trying to restrict Medicaid eligibility. So the system that provides health care to low-income people, they want to curb that and cut that back. In each of those areas, we're going to be planning on fighting them. There's a related issue, of course, on the access to medicines and that are otherwise unaffordable. We're the leading campaigning organization on that in the country, arguably in the world. Although Trump talks a big game about drug prices, you know, last time he was in office, he took a big pharma executive to be head of his health, Department of Health and Human Services. So the talk isn't matched by the action. In fact, the action is going the opposite direction and trying to protect big pharma monopolies and price gouging. We feel pretty good about our ability to block his efforts to do that. So we're with you. We're on it. We're going to do our best. We've got a bunch of questions, but I think we're out of time. Let me just send one final question over to Beverly from the other Beverly on my queue from California.
Hi, I'm Beverly on the other coast. my thing is, with people feeling as helpless and hopeless as they are, causing a lot of them to vote for Trump, is anybody doing anything to try to involve people more at a grassroots level in actions, demonstrations, anything like that moving forward that can, you know, make people feel like they have some kind of say, some kind of input, something they can actually do? So that's kind of my question.
Well, it's a really important one for us to end on, actually. I mean, I think you're touching on what we're all feeling, you know, the sort of pain and the anger and the fear. It can be debilitating, but I think what we're also saying is that it can lead to determination and, you know, the drive to regroup and rebuild our strength and reconnect in our communities as you're describing and just win the fights that are ahead of us. And I think that's really the source of our power as a movement. We don't give up. We don't back down. We don't count ourselves out. We just pick ourselves back up as activists to fight again. And we're reflecting right now on all the best and most strategic ways to do that. But we are going to regroup, rebuild, and win. You know, at the grassroots level, one of the things that I know we at Public Citizen and others are encouraging folks to do are have community meetings to do this reflection together, to think about what makes the most sense in each locality. Because a lot of what we're learning from this election is that we weren't always listening in the way we needed to, and we want to make sure we do things right. So that's an action that we're calling for, and I know a lot of other orgs are as well. Sort of deep community meetings over the next month or so. Another quick thing I just want to frame up to the earlier question about executive actions and pushing Biden, we are going to be circulating an important petition, and others are too, to push for them to do everything they can right now. That's a very concrete thing that will help, you know, again, sort of create some speed bumps, and we think it's very important. So do want to encourage folks to sign that when you see it, and encourage others to do the same, as that's a very near-term, important deliverable. Rob, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, our ability, all of us, not just the staff here, to engage together is the most important thing to forestall the worst of what we might get from Donald Trump. So in terms of ways to be involved, you know, in your community, as Lisa said, we're going to have these community meetings going forward. We've spent a lot of effort over the last 8 years or so building up an infrastructure to have consistent events around the country, whether they're protests or video showings, you know, at the town hall or at somebody's home, and everything in between. And I think that's going to be more important going forward than ever. It's going to be important for us to come together, to take care of each other, to support each other, to engage in community, to do things together, to not be isolated, not to feel isolated. It's going to be important for us to do things together to build power and show that people are not willing to go along with cruelty and corruption and giveaways and meanness and anti-health, and rollbacks of consumer protection, rollbacks of abortion rights, tax on vulnerable people, trans kids, on and on. It's going to matter that we do those things together. And, you know, we've got a long list of things that we're planning on doing, which we've alluded to without really elaborating. But the most important thing is pulling people together. So we're going to be doing that. I hope that we've been in contact with all of you in one way or another. We really appreciate the community and the support that you provide for Public Citizen. If you're someone who uses the web and the internet, you can always keep track of what we're doing at our website at citizen.org. If you're not getting email communications from us, I'd encourage you to sign up to get email communications at citizen.org. We'll let you know about opportunities to do things in your area, opportunities to sign petitions that we think are strategic and make a difference, opportunities to weigh in with lawmakers and government officials, opportunities to turn out for protests, and more. And there's no point in saying anything other than it's going to be a hard 4 years. But we really believe that the best way to deal with this challenge is to lean in, to come together, to support each other, and that together we're going to make a difference. So we know we've done that in the past. We're really confident that all of us together will be able to do it in the future. We really appreciate everything you do with and for us. Thank you so much. It's going to be the end of this Public Citizen Town Hall. It's just the beginning or ongoing part of a conversation that we're all having together. So please stay connected to us, and we're going to stay connected to you. Thanks, everybody.